Hello, I'm Rich Kilgariff. Welcome to Bookomi. We're here to get smarter, faster, together with the very best new nonfiction full of original, memorable insights. That's the OMI in Bookomi, from the most wanted minds in business, science, technology, and culture. In this episode...
Hi, I'm Sam Harris, author of the book Making Sense and host of the podcast by that name. And this is my OMI for Bookomi.
With a BA in philosophy and a PhD in cognitive neuroscience, Sam Harris is a wildly popular podcaster, meditation app creator, entrepreneur, journalist, and New York Times bestselling author who helps millions of people make sense of the world and their place within it.
I just feel very strongly that we need to get to a future where the superficial characteristics of a person's so-called identity don't matter. In our clearest moments, we all feel in our bones that's the only future worth aspiring toward. I mean, this is very much the kind of future that someone like Martin Luther King Jr. in the States talked about when he talked about people being judged by the contents of their character, not the color of their skin.
In his latest book, Making Sense, Conversations on Consciousness, Morality, and the Future of Humanity, Sam Harris has transcribed and edited 12 of his most powerful podcast encounters with brilliant thinkers on matters that shape our past, present, and future selves, asking the reader to question who, why, and what they are in the current climate of political mayhem, violence, and social uncertainty. Everything, he says, from the maintenance of civilization to the moral progress of our species, depends on a series of successful conversations. And no pressure there then. Well, Sam, welcome to this conversation on Bookomi.
Oh, happy to be here. Thank you.
Now, Sam, what I love about your work is, given the intellectual pedigrees of your guests and the sense that you're always learning or looking to learn, you don't dumb down subjects or try to distill ideas into neat lists or cheats or hacks, and yet you have a huge following. How do you describe your audience, and have you always known who they were or who you wanted them to be?
You know, I probably haven't thought as much about who the audience is as you would expect. I mean, I just tend to follow my interests, and I have the conversation that I want to have with a guest and the conversation I would want to hear. And I try to engage people on topics where, you know, more often than not, I have at least a semi-well-formed opinion, right? So it's not just a standard interview where I'm asking questions and having the guest inform me in the audience. I mean, occasionally that happens, but rather often I'm taking up, I don't know, 40% of the conversation and sort of pressure testing my views against the views of you know, rather often someone who knows more about the topic than I do. I mean, someone who's a specialist in the field. It strives to be a real conversation. And yeah, I don't dumb it down because, there'd be no reason for me to dumb it down for myself. And, you know, I mean, occasionally there's some hand-holding where if a term comes out and I have a sense that a significant percentage of the audience might not know it, you know, I might, you know, somewhat pedantically define it, but you know, there's not a ton of that. So yeah, it really is, the origin of it is fairly selfish in I'm just having the conversations I want to have. And it just turns out by sheer good luck that there's an audience for that.
I wanted to talk first about the book and the choice of medium for the book. The technologist Tim O'Reilly says that books allow us to pass fire from mind to mind between the ages. And you asked your guests to edit their version of each conversation. Does that suggest that you have a slightly higher regard for the permanence or the effect of the written word on the minds of future generations?
Well, it just seemed like an opportunity to produce the final form of these conversations. So, you know, as you know, when you're just talking into a mic, what, you know, you get what you get, and you really don't get an opportunity to perfectly refine the statement, you know, much less think better of it and change it in any significant way. I mean, there's some of that that goes on in a conversation. You can revisit points that came up earlier, and you can take your foot out of your mouth. But there's a fluidity to conversation, and you know, it really is in many cases the first draft of a person's thoughts on any given topic, even if it's a topic they've thought a lot about. You get asked a question or you run into an opposing argument, and if it's off the cuff, if your response is off the cuff, it really is off the cuff. And so there was an opportunity to sharpen this up for print and also just make the exchanges a little more readable, because our expectations of print are, as you know, are different than the expectations of our ear when just listening to a conversation. So I wanted to see, it was just an exercise in scientific and in some cases, you know, political communication, just to see if it made sense to put in the further effort to refine what had, you know, already been good conversations for audio and bring them into print.
And they were, in polishing them in print, you do present a different experience. And I listened to one of the same and read it. And it's an interesting depth of experience that you have when you're reading and you're listening. And listening to your conversations, I notice how skillful you are at adjusting the tempo, or whether it's conscious or not, tempo and the tone to suit your topic and your guest. Like with Ricky Gervais in the podcast, it was like a game of knowledge tennis. While with Jordan Peterson, and forgive my metaphor cocktail here, it felt like a mental grapple, a wrestle, taking turns to release each other from a headlock. And
yeah,
that was a fascinating
Release
encounter.
Each other.
Not release each other. Yeah. Was that one of your favorites? Because it was a fascinating exchange.
No, it definitely wasn't. I mean, it was pretty frustrating. If you're referring to the first one.
I was referring to the second one, actually. And I have listened to the first one, and that's why you did the second one, isn't it? So you kind of went back. And I have a lot of respect and admiration for both of you doing that. He apologized to you. And I have to ask you this question, because you're obviously an incredibly civil person and engaged. But he apologized to you, and then you didn't apologize to him. Were you conscious of that?
You know, I can't say that I was. I might have been, but I don't actually recall that. And I don't even recall the apology. I mean, you know, it did seem ultimately, you know, I came away from that first conversation convinced that a conversation with him on this topic was more or less impossible. I mean, it was very, you know, you could hear my frustration the first conversation. We're talking about the nature of truth, and he was making claims that I considered to be quite crazy in the end, or at least which is to say that I was burning a lot of fuel trying to convince myself that he actually believed what he said he believed, right? It just did not make sense to me. I think I've since come to understand his view better. I mean, we did two podcasts, but then we also did four public debates.
He did the shows,
One of which was in the UK, at the O2 Arena. That was an event. And then we did one in Dublin that was also enormous. And those were fun. And we sort of, we learned how to navigate each other's biases enough to actually produce enjoyable conversations where we, you know, I'm not sure we made much progress, but it didn't break down the way the first conversation did. I mean, the first conversation bordered on becoming uncivil just because of the level of mutual incomprehension and frustration. Yeah, I mean, I like Jordan a lot, and you know, so there's no ill will was accrued as a result of that first conversation. We've gone on to have several other happy encounters.
I know, and you're the only person I've ever heard interview him who made him come across as actually civil and actually empathetic. He's normally shouting someone down. He's normally haranguing someone. He's normally browbeating them.
Yeah, in his defense, he's often encountering someone who has no intention of understanding his point of view. It's a kind of performance on their side, and they're trying to make him look bad. I mean, they have some notion of who he is, you know, as a kind of sinister person in the world, and they're coming to him with a political agenda, and he's trying to make sense, you know, under the shadow of that intention. And so he's had some very weird encounters, which, you know, have, to the delight of his fans, have just exposed this shell game of, you know, at least this wing of the media in how they engage him. Yeah, it's been amusing to watch.
Well, it was great. Well, thank you for actually persisting with the conversation, because I think what came of it was, and the event, because actually, you know, you had a great conversation with him in the end. And growing up in Los Angeles in the 70s, just to change tack slightly there. What were you like as a child and a teenager? I ask because in one of the conversations featured in the book with Robert Sapolsky, you talk about the late maturing of the prefrontal cortex in the brain and how our understanding of consequences and action doesn't kick in until our mid-20s. Did you notice a change in yourself in your 20s, and what happened as a result?
I don't know that I would ascribe it merely to the maturation of my frontal cortex, because I can see the influence of ideas coming in around that time as well. But who knows what is cause and what is effect there. But it was around age 18 that the prospect of living an examined life and taking ethics very seriously and you know, just, you know, moral philosophy and a consideration of, you know, what life means and what are the possibilities of living a much better life than one would tend to by happenstance. All of that came online for me at around age 18. And we can talk about the reasons why, but this is when it was initially provoked by an experience with MDMA, you know, otherwise known as ecstasy. So, you know, not a classic psychedelic, but, you know, a drug that has had a very powerful effect on many people, certainly people who've taken it kind of with a therapeutic or introspective, you know, contemplative intention. And yeah, it's not too much to say that it was a genuine revelation to me, that the experience I had there, and it reoriented me intellectually and ethically in a very powerful way. And that, you know, I took that into, I mean, it was actually, honestly, it was beginning before that. You know, I mean, that was my sophomore year in college where I had that experience. So, but I remember my freshman year in college, I was already starting to think very differently about just, you know, what it means to live a good life. And yeah, you know, I don't remember a ton of that going on in high school. High school was much more a matter of striving to be a good student for all the prosaic reasons and attempting to have as much fun as possible. So it was a certain level of testosterone poisoning of my brain that I remember from being a teenager. But once I got into college, my philosophical interests came more online.
And you pursued those through your 20s, didn't you? You went away, basically. You went on tour. You went to India and you studied Buddhism and Hinduism, and you came back a different person by all accounts.
Yeah. Yeah. I dropped out of college after my sophomore year, and that was precipitated by two things. One is I knew I wanted to be a writer at that point, but I thought I wanted to write novels. So the necessity of finishing school just kind of evaporated for me, because it was just clear to me that if you're going to write the great American novel, well, then there is no alternative but to just sit down and do it. And there's really no need to have any kind of, you know, academic background, but to rest on to do it. You know, so why not do it sooner rather than later and get rid of all of these other obligations? So it was sort of on the wings of that inspiration that I decided to drop out. But I was also getting very interested in meditation specifically, and wanting to sit extended meditation retreats and go to India and Nepal and study. And so I did that as well. But at some point, fairly early on in my 20s, my interest in writing changed to writing nonfiction. And then, you know, I was slow to have this epiphany, but then it became, you know, anyone could have told me immediately relevant that I had dropped out of school, because if I'm going to publish nonfiction about the nature of the mind and, you know, its relationship to the brain and anything else that might interest me, it would matter that I didn't have any kind of academic background on the basis of which to do that. So, and to be self-taught, to be merely self-taught at that point would not have been ideal. So that at that eventually I wound up going back to school and finishing my degree in philosophy and then doing a PhD in neuroscience.
Because you majored in English literature, didn't you? That's what you dropped out of.
Yeah, the first time I was studying English and sitting in, you know, fiction writing workshops, and really I wanted to be a fiction writer, and I just loved books, and I was certainly very argumentative, you know, philosophically. I love debate, and I was interested in philosophy, but I don't think I considered it as a major at that point. I really knew I wanted to be a writer when I went into as a freshman. And so it wasn't until I came back, having spent really a decade mostly reading philosophy and certainly some science, but I spent a decade essentially educating myself in the philosophy of mind and moral philosophy, and, you know, mostly Western, but also, you know, a fair amount of Eastern study along with the study of meditation. So when I went back, it was just natural for me to finish in philosophy.
And in the preface to the book, you say that you've long been a believer in the unity of knowledge and that the boundaries between traditional disciplines should be generally ignored. Do you agree with the science fiction author Robert Heinlein, who said that specialization is for insects? And would you consider yourself a modern polymath?
Well, I wouldn't agree with Heinlein there. I know that quote. I don't remember the context of it, so maybe he's not quite making that point. But yeah, I think specialization is certainly necessary for some sorts of progress, right? It's, you know, it's the only reason why we know much more now about the world than we did 5 years ago, and much more than we did 50 years ago, is because so many people have specialized. So it's, I wouldn't want to throw that out, but there's definitely a role for people who are more have more of a generalist approach to knowledge, and there's certainly a role for specialists to disregard the very steep channels that have grown up around their narrow efforts to look over the top of the wall and see if they can make a contribution to an adjacent field. So for a physicist to decide to pay attention to molecular biology, say, or a philosopher of mind to start studying neuroscience with an eye toward clarifying certain concepts. It just seems to me that that's often where some of the more interesting insights are had, because you don't have someone who's just merely following the track laid down by predecessors in that field. And it is just, in fact, true that nature is not arranged at in conformity to our map of it, right? I mean, it's just we have a map of reality that is to some degree now dictated by the architectural plan of a university, right? Where you have the philosophy department over here, and then some distant place across the campus you have neuroscience, and then showing no relationship to those two buildings you have chemistry, say. And the reality is, if you're talking about human thought and its neurophysiological underpinnings, and you're talking about those disciplines at every level at some point, and I think you want to be able to range freely across the boundaries between those disciplines, and university budgets and the mechanics of writing grants to funding institutions, and none of that really matters. I mean, certainly reality isn't tracking those distinctions, and so I think we should be free to just kind of move across these traditional boundaries between ideas.
Thoughts echoed in Peter Burke. The historian's got a book out next month called The Polymath, A Cultural History. And it points out that whenever there's been a scientific lunge forward, that polymaths, or the desire to diversify knowledge, emerge to sort of mop up knowledge from all areas. And then society, institutions like universities, fragment that knowledge to try and create a sense of order. Do you think we're in a lunge forward now with the acceleration of technology and the acceleration of our understanding of the world and computer science? Are we in a lunge forward now where there's going to be a new age of, if not polymaths, but a need for diversity?
Yeah, well, I think we should take this concept of being a polymath rather lightly or figuratively now. I mean, there was once a time where you really could be a true polymath, and I think that passed us, I don't know, 50 years ago or so. I mean, just the doubling time of knowledge in any specific field is probably down to 3 years now, so, which is to say that if you knew all of biology 3 years ago, you know exactly half today, or something like that, if you're talking about specific findings. So it's, but you can be polymathic in aspiration and in spirit, and I certainly try to be that. I mean, I'm interested in so many things, and I see the points of connection between these things, again, regardless of what a standard curriculum in a university would say about their connections. So those are the conversations I want to have, where we're talking about, the foundations of human knowledge at one point, and their implications for, how we understand technological progress at another, the practical applications of our uncertainty about human epistemology, and then suddenly, does this have implications for the kinds of machines we build, and what we think about them in the future? And it's just the boundary between the philosophy of science and the practical and ethical concerns that arise when we look at how we're changing ourselves and our society by what we come to know. There's no, I see no bright lines between those sentences in a conversation. So I just want to be able to flow over, you know, those apparent boundaries and talk about what matters.
You do ebb and flow over humanities, science, back and forth. It's like listening to you in your conversations is like listening to a loom weaving a tapestry. And by the end of it, you feel much more aware of everything, even though you can't, you know, obviously you're not an expert in the subjects of the experts that you interview, but you get a sense of knowledge and you get a sense of the ebb and flow and the nuances of knowledge. And I spoke to David Eagleman about this just recently, about philosophy and neuroscience and how, you know, you can't have a conversation today about neuroscience without blending it with philosophy, really, can you? Because there's so much at stake to the future of humanity. We were talking, he and I, about the live wiring of the human brain and the complexity involved in replicating the human mind. And reading and listening to you speak, I was trying to understand and get my head around whether I see consciousness as created by our past experiences, our memories, served up into our present senses, or if I prefer to leave consciousness as a mystery, just as, say, an astrophysicist might see before the Big Bang as the unknown a mystery. Did your conversations change your mind? Do they change your mind on the subject of consciousness?
Well, that really is the one subject where I think where we haven't made really any intellectual progress, which is to say it is fundamentally still a mystery. What consciousness is, its relationship to the physics of things. So yeah, I can't say my sense of that has changed. I either see people acknowledge this mystery and then talk about the places, you know, the adjacent spaces where we clearly have made progress, you know, in understanding the human mind and all of its capacities, or I see people disregard the mystery and make what appear to me to be obvious philosophical errors in their, you know, insouciant statements about how much progress we're making here and how the, you know, this hole in our understanding will soon get closed. But you see, there are people in the book who totally acknowledge the nature of the problem, more or less from the perspective I do, people like David Chalmers and Anil Seth. And yeah, it's called the hard problem of consciousness by Chalmers for a good reason, because it really is confounding to our intuitions about what it would mean to explain any phenomenon. Right. I mean, what we're essentially talking about when you're asking what is consciousness and how does it emerge, you're talking about the transition from nothing to something, in this case, subjectively, in the same way that you're talking about the transition from nothing to something when you're asking the question, you know, why is there, you know, anything rather than nothing? You know, where did the laws of physics come from? It's pretty obvious that physics hasn't made much progress and probably can't make much progress on that most foundational question. You know, why is there anything? And, you know, positing nothing, positing zero at the outset, if there ever was such a thing as zero, how did the emergence of anything, including the laws by which any other thing would emerge, get started? That just might in principle be impossible to think about. And I think we're at a similar stalemate on the topic of consciousness. You're imagining that there's some, if you're, you know, a normal scientist of mind who believes that consciousness emerges at some level of complexity, some level of information processing or, you know, functional arrangement of a complex system such that the lights go on, right? There's some necessary and sufficient conditions to the emergence of subjectivity. Well, then you're, in my view, restating a kind of miracle. Right. Which is to say that even if we had the answer, even if we knew what the criteria were, it would seem like a miracle. You know, if it's just a fact that you need 10,000 information processing units and not one less arranged in a certain hierarchy and firing away within a certain time window, you know, let's say that has to be 500 milliseconds. And that is just a fact. You know, we could look in the back of the book of nature and discover that fact. That's those are the necessary and sufficient conditions for consciousness in a physical system. Well, that, you know, that doesn't explain anything. That's just an amazing confusing fact that is totally indigestible intuitively. And yet, when you look at what scientific explanation is on any other front, it's not, we're not dealing with those kinds of brute facts. We're dealing with higher level phenomenon that become, whose character becomes more understandable once we discover the micro level phenomenon that give rise to them. And so, you know, when we're talking about something like, you know, understanding the mechanisms by which living systems function and propagate themselves, and then we discover the internal machinery of the cell, and you know, the role that DNA plays in, you know, cellular repair and in biological inheritance, and all of it is very complicated, but it is also explanatory, right? When we learn the details, we see that the mystery is receding. I don't see how we get there in this transition from nothing to something on the matter of consciousness. But, you know, I hope to be proven wrong there, but I am skeptical.
It's like we haven't moved on since Shakespeare and King Lear shouted, "Nothing will come of nothing." We haven't moved on from there, have we? From a scientific point of view, I suppose. You discuss morality and psychology with Daniel Kahneman, and in particular the psychology of redemption and apologies in civil society. How do you think our so-called cancel culture is affecting our ability to forgive people for misdemeanors or talking out of turn? Where should we draw the actual ethical line, in your opinion, with crime? If someone is mentally ill, for instance, and perhaps curable, but they murder someone while ill, should we let them back into the fold when they have clinically recovered?
On one level, this is a very practical, even political question. But on another, it's a very deep question about what we think human mind is, and it touches philosophically controversial ideas around, you know, free will or its absence, right? So if you believe in free will, if you believe that people really are the true causes of their intentions and behaviors, you can form one view of, you know, things like punishment, right? Like the people, you can have a retributive notion of punishment, which is, you know, people who do bad things really do deserve their punishments in a deep sense. Whereas if you believe, as I do, that free will as a concept makes absolutely no sense, and there's no picture of causation in the universe or in a human brain, cashes out this intuition that most of us have, that people are the true authors of their actions, and which is to say they could have done, if someone does a bad thing and it is intelligible to say that they could have done otherwise under precisely those same circumstances. If you rewound the movie of their lives, they would be in a position where the movie could come out differently, you know, if they only decided to behave differently. There's no evidence we live in a universe of that sort, and it's really impossible, you know, or so I argue at some length in my book Free Will, and in, you know, in the Waking Up app, where I talk about this in the context of meditation. The truth is, there's no evidence for free will is subjectively either. If you look at just the way your thoughts and intentions and reactions arise in your mind, there's a serious fact there, which is you don't know what you're going to think until you think it, right? You don't know what you'll intend until the intention itself arises. You don't know that you'll resist that intention until your resistance arises, and you can't, you're not in a position to understand why you had precisely that degree of impulse control in that moment and not a jot more or less, right? It's just, you as a conscious witness of your experience aren't in the position of creating anything, really. And people hear that initially and they think, well, that is just the ruination of everything we care about. That's a kind of a nihilistic view of any human project, but it's not. If you follow this reasoning to the end, you see that this grants a much broader picture of human freedom. And, you know, most importantly for the topic you just raised, it cancels the logic of hatred, right? And the idea that you can really, that it makes sense, ethical sense to hate people and want to punish them from a retributive point of view. Now, this doesn't cancel any need for punishment. Punishment in certain cases is the only way to influence, you know, other people's behavior. And when it matters, we want to influence their behavior, right? So everything from, you know, telling people they can't park in a certain place on the street, you know, and if they do, we will fine them, you know, we'll ticket their cars. You know, that influences their behavior, and that's the right thing to do. Otherwise, what, we would just have, you know, cars everywhere. You know, people would park directly on the sidewalk if we let them. And so it's not that punishment in that case goes away. It's just the logic of it is not retributive. The logic is this is the mechanism by which we can modify people's behavior successfully, and we want a certain outcome in the world, and so these are the rules, and this is how we'll enforce them. And so that also covers every other kind of human misbehavior, right? So you take the worst case scenario. You have someone who is the prototypically evil person, you know, a psychopath who gets pleasure causing others to suffer. And this person would, if you left him to his own devices, just be out there raping and killing people in his spare time. We don't have a real remedy for all that is wrong with this person's character, which is to say all that is wrong at the most basic level with his brain, right? But if we did have a cure, if we had a pill that we could give someone which would eradicate human evil, right, without, you know, any other intolerable side effect, we would just give that pill, right? We would catch the evil people and say, all right, take this, you know, this would not be voluntary. They would, given the risks they pose to the rest of society, they would have to take this pill. But, you know, upon taking it, again, stipulating that this really is a cure for human evil, what we would witness is a complete transformation of this person. This person would say, oh my God, I cannot believe I was living that way. I'm so sorry, to thank you for relieving me of this burden. And just imagine if we got there, if evil at its, however complex it really is neurophysiologically, if we understood it sufficiently such that we could completely eradicate it. And again, this is a cartoon, you know, it would be very unlikely to be a pill, but whatever the intervention was, what would we feel about all of the evil people, you know, languishing in our prisons now, who, quote, really deserve to be punished for their misdeeds, right? Like that the whole set of intuitions that made it seem that justified the retributive justice that was meted out to them would evaporate, because we would suddenly, now understanding the biology of human evil, we would see, okay, wait a minute, these people were at bottom unlucky, right? It's unlucky to be born to the set of conditions, genetic and environmental, that dictated this pattern of life. And now we have a cure for that, right? Now we could, you know, literally empty the jails because we so fully understand the mechanics here. Just think of how perverse it would be for someone to say, no, this person did these horrible things. They deserve to rot in prison. And as part of their punishment, will withhold this cure for evil from them, because it's just, at a certain point, if we really understand ourselves, the problem of, you know, something like psychopathy will be analogous to a resolutely physical problem like diabetes, right? And it just, you don't blame people for being diabetic, and you won't blame people for being psychopathic once psychopathy resolves itself into an understandable condition of the brain. And that can't help but change our ethical and our ethical intuitions and the way in which we implement them in our laws.
Well, it's almost as if we want justice to make sense of the world, isn't it? So that if something goes wrong, or if we don't like what someone says or does from across the whole spectrum, we want there to be some kind of order, some kind of system, be it divine justice or civil justice. We want to see wrongs righted. We want to see balance. And that need to understand or communicate with other people. You touched upon political correctness, which I think is a form of code between in society and culture. And you touched on it with Ricky Gervais about being woke or aware of current modes of acceptable discourse and behavior. How do you feel about positive discrimination in race and gender in terms of how it affects outcomes from, you know, from a scientific point of view? And I notice, and I hope I'm not just picking a fight here, but there are no women in the list of the 12 conversations in the book.
Yeah.
Did you feel pressure to include a female neuroscientist or psychologist or philosopher? Which also begs the question, weren't there more of them? But is trying to understand the world a predominantly male preoccupation? Were you conscious of that mix?
Yeah. So yeah, when I was searching for conversations to include in this volume that would seem to knit together, I did look for women, and I was surprised to find that I didn't have a conversation with a woman who would function well here. And there's some reasons for that. And I think there's just the statistical fact that in many of these fields that I'm focusing on, women are underrepresented. I mean, it's just a fact. If you're looking in philosophy in particular, there are far fewer women philosophers, and this is true of physics. It's true of many of the topics I touch in this book. But that's not the only problem, and I don't know whether the problem was on my side or this is also just a sociological fact. But when I went back and listened to the conversations I've had with some great women on my podcast, they have tended to be far more topical than some of the other kinds of conversations I was looking for, which is to say we were talking about things in the news that were important at the time. We talked a lot about Trump. And so by their very nature, these conversations weren't going to age as well as the conversations I put in the book. And that could just be that, you know, when I feel like I need to talk about something in the news or politics, for whatever reason, that's the time where I have gravitated toward speaking with one of these women, and, you know, who's, you know, could be just as accomplished as any male guest in her own right. But I've used the conversation to a purpose that you know isn't going to age well, and that, you know, it could be on me. I just simply don't know. But and it's something that I think I will be more sensitive to going forward, because it does strike me as peculiar to only have men in this particular book. The larger question of you know, racism, sexism, and cancel culture, you know, as a response to it, or political correctness, you know, surrounding the way we talk about these things. I just feel very strongly that we need to get to a future where the superficial characteristics of a person's, you know, so-called identity don't matter. In our clearest moments, we all feel in our bones that's the only future worth aspiring toward. I mean, this is very much the kind of future that someone like Martin Luther King Jr. in the States talked about when he talked about people being judged by the contents of their character, not the color of their skin. And yet what we're noticing politically, particularly in the US, but this is now a global phenomenon, is that we seem to have retreated from that aspiration and grown quite confused by my lights, by, you know, something that's generally referred to as identity politics. And what you're getting a lot of in intellectual discourse, in, you know, in journalism, in even in science, is the assertion, the quite bullying assertion, that identity is paramount, right? And that we need to live in a world that is shattered by competing identity claims, and that race and ethnicity and gender and, you know, biological sex really matter in a deep way. And that to disregard these demands is a sign of, you know, living in an unethical society, living with you know, maintaining inequality, you know, quite perversely, because it advantages your group. You know, especially if you happen to be a white, cisgendered male, you're considered culpable for not being interested in this project of maintaining these in truth ultimately incommensurable identity claims. And I just feel that what is obvious to me, and what I think should be obvious to everyone else, is that we need to get to a future where, you know, take race and skin color as the most salient variable here. We need to get to a future where differences in skin color and differences in so-called race are as interesting as differences in hair color, right? Which is to say, they're not interesting at all, right? I mean, you can admire people's hair colors, but no one would think that to ask the question, are there enough blondes in positions of senior management at Google, right? Like, we've looked at the nation's doctors, and we found that though redheads are whatever, you know, X percent of the population, you know, in the field of cardiology, there's only, you know, 1/2 X redheads. And so this suggests that there's some systematic exclusion of redheads from the ranks of our nation's cardiologists. And we need to look into that. And you need a quota for redheads now going forward. I mean, this would be quite obviously insane to a regime of this kind of sensitivity to hair color would be obviously insane to impose on ourselves. Now, I'm not an idiot. I know what our history is. I know the history we're struggling to put behind us. And we do have a history of racial animus and prejudice, and you know, there are real victims of racial bias in our societies. We've outgrown this to an immense degree, and we are failing to acknowledge that progress now to a degree that's fairly bewildering. And we are insisting that we maintain a type of thinking that I think will prevent the further progress that we have to make. And so again, if we keep the goal in sight, I mean, the analogy to hair color isn't perfect, but I think it's instructive. I mean, you really do want to get to a world in which it is totally uninteresting it has no implication what color a person's hair is for anything. And the question is, how do we get there? And it just seems obvious to me that caring more and more about racial identity is not a method of getting there. And caring more and more about gender is not a method of getting there. And it's, you know, and yet that is not that, you know, if you're going to talk about cancel culture and political correctness and certainly anything that's happening on the far left of the political spectrum, that's not the organizing set of intuitions that's ruling the day. And it's a problem at a minimum, it's a problem because it is creating a backlash, which is a competing form of identity politics. And if you're going to bang on endlessly about the need for identity politics, you will inspire a countervailing, you know, in the extreme white male identity politics as a reaction. And, you know, there's nothing more idiotic at this moment in history than white male identity politics, right? But it is being inspired by what's happening on the left.
Interesting. It's a very tricky and emotional argument, isn't it? Because some might say that the goal to do away with those politics or identity politics and get to a point where it doesn't matter. There's very few people that would disagree with the virtue and the desirability of that goal. But I suppose some might argue that the maintenance of that goal at the moment is the privilege or the luxury of people who haven't been on the receiving end of the negative effects of that racism. Do you see where I'm coming from with that?
Yeah, I mean, that argument would be made, and people would also dispute the goal. I mean, that's also how far it's gone on the left, that, you know, that goal can't even be aspired to. And I mean, just this is dysfunctional from so many sides. But I mean, just look at the recent, I mean, to take a topical issue, you know, just, you know, American politics. We just have the vice presidential running mate for Joe Biden announced, Kamala Harris. But for now, for months, it's been known that he was seeking a woman because, you know, he felt he had to and it was time. And for you know, nearly as long, it has been speculated with a kind of fervency that made it more or less a fait accompli that this woman had to be a woman of color. Otherwise, that would be some kind of scandal. So everyone knew that it could not possibly, his running mate could not possibly be a man, whatever the needs of the moment, or and was very unlikely to be one of the white women who were, you know, obvious candidates, someone like Elizabeth Warren. And so given that those parameters, Joe Biden has now unveiled Kamala Harris as his running mate. Now, Kamala Harris is totally qualified to be his running mate. And if you just you know, flip this around, go back in time, whatever it was, 5-6 months, and imagine that Joe Biden said, I'm not going to be held to any politically correct parameters here. I'm simply going to pick the best person for this job. I mean, you just know that the person I put forward will be the person I think is most qualified to step in, you know, should something happen to me on day one. And, you know, that's the only test here. And then imagine if, you know, after, you know, 5 months of silent rumination, he comes forward with Kamala Harris. And just think of how much better that would have been for her and her candidacy, right? And the framing of her as a running mate, it would have been immensely better, right? Because then he would just say, yeah, she happens to be a woman. She happens to be a woman of color. But the reality is she's the best person I could find in our country for this job. Now, you know, whether people, you know, there'd be cynical people who wouldn't really be able to believe that, and they wouldn't take that at face value, and they would know that there's all kinds of left-wing political calculations going on in the background here. But it is so much, it would be so much better if we could break this spell and just put, you know, if he could have just put forward, you know, the person he wanted to run with, and then lo and behold, people could see that she also checked these other boxes. But to have reversed that process and to filter by these, you know, politically correct variables of it has to be a woman and it has to be a woman of color, it is in fact demeaning of Kamala Harris. You know, it's just, there's no pretense at all that he was seeking the best possible person for this job. And again, I think she might in fact have been the best possible person, given the likely people he could have picked. But the whole process is derogatory of her as an individual, and the fact that people can't see that is mystifying to me.
Sam Harris, thank you so much for sharing your OMI with Bokomi today.
Oh well, thank you. It's been a pleasure, Rich.
Sam's book, Making Sense: Conversations on Consciousness, Morality, and the Future of Humanity, is available to buy now. Just follow the link in the description of the podcast. If you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new nonfiction before anyone else, sign up to our monthly most wanted email at Bokomi.com. Meanwhile, if you enjoyed this Bokomi pod with the amazing Sam Harris, please let us know by following or subscribing on Apple, Spotify, and Google audio platforms. I'm Rich Kilgariff. Stay safe, stay smart, and remember, life is for living and learning. Bye for now.